All right, well, thanks for the introduction, and thank you for having me. This has been a really great, I've been here for almost a week now. It's been a great series of talks and great interactions with people. I've had a great time, so thank you very much for inviting me. So I'm going to talk about variability today. And the title of my talk is Variance as a Signature of Neural Computations During Decision Making. And a lot of people have thought about variability in the past. We heard talk about variability just today. And I think what I'm going to tell you about today is a rather different take on neural variability. People have, of course, known for a long time that cortical neurons are variable. This just shows responses from an LIP neuron. It's almost the same stimulus from trial to trial, but each little tick is a spike, and you can see that the responses on each trial are quite different. And in the past, people have wondered things along the lines of, you know, can the animal make use of this variability? Perhaps there's information contained in this variance. Or people have wondered, you know, perhaps this variability plays some role in motor output, like the talk this morning. Perhaps the variability assists an animal in learning some new kind of sequence or motor output. But my approach is really quite different. And instead of asking what the variability can do for the animal, I'm going to ask sort of instead, what can it do for us as experimenters? And specifically, I'm going to ask, can the variability help constrain the kind of neural mechanism that's at work in different kinds of tasks and at different times in the same task? And the way that, as a community, I think that we've traditionally gone about elucidating different kinds of neural mechanisms is by looking at the mean responses of neurons. So we'll look at average firing rate. We take a, this is not a pointer, is it? We take a series of trials and average them together, perhaps counting up spikes in some window, get some estimate of the mean, and then relate that mean to some kind of model or at least mechanism, and try to argue for the existence of that mechanism or model based on mean firing rates. And what I'm going to argue about today is that by looking beyond the mean and looking at the variability, one can have the opportunity to distinguish neural mechanisms that make identical predictions for mean firing rate. So the traditional approach of just looking at firing rates sometimes doesn't make it possible to distinguish putative models or putative neural mechanisms, while the variance can make it possible to distinguish those. So just as a roadmap for the talk, I'm going to start by telling you about behavior on a random dot motion decision task, which many of you probably know about already, excuse me, and describe to you its proposed neural mechanism. Then I'm going to tell you about predictions for neural variability that are inherent to that mechanism that I'm going to favor. Then I'll tell you about neural variability in the data, and you can see whether you agree that it matches the predictions that the model makes. And finally, I'm going to tell you about a very related measure, the predictions about the temporal correlations, and I'll tell you more about what I mean by that later in the talk, that are inherent to the particular neural mechanism. And then finally, I'll tell you about temporal correlations in the data. So I'll start here by talking about the behavior. So if you're familiar with this task, you can tune out for a moment and then tune back in when we go to the next slide. So this is a random dot motion task that I've done in awake behaving monkeys. It starts with the appearance of a fixation point, which the animals will look at. And then after a variable delay, two choice targets appear. In the data set that I'll be telling you about today, there are sometimes two and sometimes four choice targets, depending on whether the animal is engaged in a two-choice or a four-choice decision task. After a second variable delay, a random dot motion stimulus appears. It's presented centrally. And some of these dots are moving together in the same direction, and the remaining dots are moving around randomly in different directions. And on each trial, we set the percentage of dots that are moving together in the same direction to control the difficulty of the trial. So if most of them are moving in the same direction, of course, it's very easy. We call that a high coherence stimulus or high motion strength. If only a small percentage are moving in the same direction, then it's much more difficult. The version of the task that I'm going to tell you about today is a reaction time version. On this version of the task, when the animal's ready, he makes a rapid ballistic eye movement called a saccade to one of the two choice targets. And in the example I just showed you, that would have happened an eternity ago, because the monkeys typically make their decisions in a second, or frequently quite a bit less than a second. And if he's chosen the correct target, that is the target that's in the same direction of the motion and the stimulus, so in this case, if you'll recall, the motion was to the right and the monkey chose the right words, target. So he would be rewarded with a drop of juice, or because these experiments are carried out in Seattle, a drop of espresso, hopefully with a Rosetta on the top. So as I said, we measure these responses in rhesus macaques, which are good animals for this kind of a decision-making task. They have a visual circuitry that's been very well studied and a lot is known about, although as I'll hint later on, other animals are also suitable for this kind of a task. So this shows the animal's behavior, and I'm going to focus on two aspects of the animal's behavior, that is their accuracy or probability correct, and then in a moment their speed. So this is the probability correct on the ordinate as a function of motion strength. So out here the motion strength is very high, the task is easy, and the monkey makes essentially no errors. Down here, the task is more difficult. He makes lots and lots of errors. You can see his probability correct is quite a bit lower. And here, this open circle on the ordinate, this describes the condition when the motion is completely random. And in conditions like that, his performance is by definition, the probability correct is by definition 0.5 because we reward the animals randomly on those trials. Okay, this shows the animal's reaction time, or the speed with which he makes his decisions, and that's the time from when the motion begins until he makes his decision. And again, you can see that this behavioral measure depends on the motion strength, which again is plotted on the abscissa. So when the motion strength is very weak, the task is difficult, the animal takes a long time to make his decision. When the task is easier, he makes his decisions much more quickly. Yes and no. On the two-choice version, well, in general, the faster he makes his decision, the sooner he might get a reward. But of course, it's a trade-off, right? Because if he makes his decision more quickly, then he's less likely to be correct. Because of course, the stimulus is stochastic, right? So the information at any given moment isn't necessarily that informative about the correct choice. So if he makes a snap judgment based on the momentary evidence over some very short interval, then his probability of being correct is much lower than if he waits longer. So we call that the speed accuracy trade-off, and we've thought a lot about it, but I'll stop with that. So the way that we do these sort of our experimental routine is that during the weekdays, so Monday through Friday, then the animal gets all of his water from the experiment, or most of his water from the experiment. So he comes into the lab, works for all his water for the day, or most of his water for the day, and then goes back to his home cage and then comes out again the next day. So the difference, and there's certainly a difference in satiety from the beginning to the end of the session, and that definitely does have some effect on performance and also how those are reflected in the brain. I'm not going to probably go into too much detail about that today, but we can talk about it later if you're interested. I think it's a really interesting topic. Yeah, go ahead. So yeah, I don't think that it's the case. Like, you might wonder whether they're to the integrator and that 600 milliseconds represents, you know, some upper limit of how long it makes sense to integrate. In fact, I think that's actually not true. Not because of this particular data set, but because of other data sets that have tried to look more directly at what the time constant of integration is. And the time constant of integration is long. It's a lot longer than 600 milliseconds. And I think probably the reason that, so you might wonder, well, why aren't these reaction times longer? And I think it's because the monkey's decision time reflects both the accumulation of evidence and also some kind of time-dependent rise that we think of the monkey, as the monkey's impending sense of urgency as time goes by. And if you think about it, particularly when animals are engaged in a two-choice task, it would be a very unwise strategy to always wait until you reach some threshold level to make a decision, because your probability of being correct is pretty high, right? It's already 50%. And so you want to make use both of the incoming information and also your knowledge of elapsed time in order to optimize the amount of reward that you're getting per unit time. Yeah, Peter. Say that again. The start. How long he wait? You mean how long his reaction time is? Yeah. No, they're not related. Yeah. So that's that. The time between trials is drawn from a completely generated independently.
Deadline, But the animal's trying to make the first possible deadline.
So I'm not sure which delay you're talking about. So the way that I have collected this data is that there's no delay between when the monkey makes his choice and when he gets the reward. There are other data sets in the lab where there is a delay. But so as soon as he executes his choice, he gets a reward. And then there's some amount of time until the next trial.
There's a delay between when he makes the decision and...
No,
between when he makes the decision, there's a delay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not like between starting the trial.
Between the start, I see what you're asking, right.
No.
That's so the total time, like from start of trial one to start of trial two, that depends on the monkey's reaction time. In the Reutemann data set, because there were no four-choice trials, she implemented a fixed delay between when the random dot motion started and when he got his reward that was, it was a bit monkey dependent, but it was on the order of about 900 milliseconds, or no, probably less than that. 700 milliseconds, something like that, the number doesn't matter. So that to discourage the monkeys from making very short reaction times. And so that kind of a setup would invite a rather different strategy from this one, where there's no fixed delay between when the motion comes on and when it doesn't. And the reason I was able to get away with this is, first of all, I was just willing to take a hit on the RTs. I mean, those are shorter RTs than the Reutemann data set. But also these are interleaved with four-choice trials, and randomly guessing on a four-choice trial is much worse strategy, because obviously the baseline reward rate's lower. And so that discourages them from that kind of a strategy. And so I was able to get away with not invoking that additional trial attribute, which I sort of wish to avoid. Okay? Totally lost track of where I am here. Okay, so just as an aside, you might wonder whether accumulating evidence for a decision is sort of a rare strategy that perhaps is limited up to primates. You also might wonder whether perhaps accumulating evidence relies on circuitry that's only present in the visual system, rather than being a strategy that's sort of general and can be used in a number of different sensory modalities. And just to put your mind at ease, this is data from a rat that I collected last summer. For these data, the animals were not presented with an ambiguous visual stimulus, but with an ambiguous auditory stimulus. But you can see that the same basic principles apply. When the stimulus is completely random, the animal's performance is a chance, and then their performance depends on the stimulus strength, and they have much better performance for higher stimulus strength trials. So hopefully this will assure you that this kind of mechanism is present not just in primates and not just in the visual system. And I should say as an aside, if you might notice some differences in the behavior here. This animal has been doing this task for about 8 years, and this rat was only trained for a month. So rats they're pretty quick. What did you say? Humans are great. I mean, they're like the monkeys. It's a little difficult to compare because they don't require training. We can explain to them the relationship between the nature of the stimulus and the appropriate motor response. That is, you know, rightward motion, look to the right, which to us seems like a very natural mapping. In fact, it isn't, and it takes a long time to teach an animal to report their percept with a saccadic eye movement. But the performance is very similar. It's essentially indistinguishable. They probably have a slightly different long-term strategy. They're probably not optimizing a reward per unit time, but maybe minimizing errors, something like that. But really similar in humans and monkeys. No, we haven't done that. It would be interesting to do. I mean, it is really difficult to, I think the degree to which that would be a useful enterprise, I think kind of depends on what kind of question you want to ask. And I think it's certainly true that the nature of the reward for the monkeys is quite different from what the humans get. Because they're thirsty and they're getting a liquid reward, it's probably invoking reward-related circuitry that's very different than the kind of circuitry that's engaged when humans do the task. So if you really were interested in how that reward-related circuitry played a role in decision making, then I agree it would be potentially a helpful thing to try and set up the human experiment in a more parallel way to the monkeys. That slide back there was to remind me to tell you that we also have data on a four-choice version of the task. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this today. This is the accuracy in red for the four-choice task. And you can see that the animals make more errors. Their probability correct is lower on four-choice compared to two-choice. Of course, there's a sense in which that's sort of a foregone conclusion. If you think about what happens when the motion is completely random, the reward rate is higher on the two-choice task. It's 0.5 instead of 0.25 because there are fewer targets. Yeah. In any of four directions, yeah. So four choice targets and four possible directions. The animals also take more time when there are four choice targets. You can see the reaction times are longer for four choice compared to two choice, and that's true at almost every motion strength that we looked at. So this is just sort of a summary. I'm not really going to focus too much on differences between two and four choice today because I want to get to these other issues about variability, but it'll come up at one other point in the talk, which is why I've taken you through that data. Okay, so we have a framework that we've used for interpreting the behavior and for connecting it to the physiology. We call this the bounded accumulation of evidence. For those of you who are drift diffusion aficionados in the audience, this is equivalent to one single drift diffusion process, but I've separated it into two races for reasons that will perhaps be evident in a moment. So the idea is that if there's a monkey who's looking at, for example, strong rightward motion, then we can model his underlying processes in his brain by thinking about these bounded accumulation frameworks. So here, this is a process in favor of a rightwards choice, and so the value of the decision variable is increasing because the motion is strong and to the right. Over here, this is a process in favor of the other choice. Of course, most of the evidence is against a leftward choice because in the example that I've set up, the motion is strong and to the right. So evidence continues to be accumulated over time until eventually it reaches some threshold level or bound, at which case the process is terminated and the choice corresponding to the bound is taken as the animal's choice. So there's a number of different instantiations of this kind of model. I'm not going to aim to distinguish them in my talk today. I just sort of want to point out that a useful, appealing feature of this model is that we can describe the animal's speed, which is the time that it takes to reach the bound, and also his accuracy, how many times did he reach the correct bound in a single mechanism. That kind of a model generated the smooth lines to the two-choice data and also the four-choice data that I showed you earlier. So it does a pretty good job of capturing the behavior, and also we think we can see a neural correlate of this in the brain. So in a moment, I'm going to invite skepticism about whether this is really the right mechanism to describe the kind of decision-making that we're seeing. But for the moment, I'll tell you why we think, about the evidence from the brain that this is the right way to think about decision-making. So now I'll tell you about its proposed neural mechanism. We record from single neurons in parietal cortex from awake animals who are engaged in decision-making tasks. Information that's relevant to the task comes into V1, then into the middle temporal area, which has motion-sensitive neurons. We think these neurons provide the momentary evidence, which is then accumulated in the lateral interparietal area, or area LIP. Area LIP is neither a purely sensory nor purely motor area, but has aspects instead of both responses. It projects to areas that are more closely tied to the generation of saccadic eye movements, for example, the frontal eye field and also the superior colliculus, which you can't see on this picture because it's underneath the brain. So I'm going to tell you what these neurons do during the random dot motion task, but I want to tell you just a little bit about their response properties generally and play you a couple of movies so you can see why we think this is an interesting place to look for neurons that reflect the accumulation of random samples of evidence. So when we select neurons to study, we look for neurons that pass what we call the memory-guided saccade task. So for this task, it starts with a fixation point, and then we put a target in the part of the visual field which we call the response field. And the response field just means the part of the visual field where if we put a target there and the monkey plans to make an eye movement, it will respond, and that's as opposed to the rest of the visual field where if we put a target there, the neuron doesn't do very much of anything. So to play you a movie of what that sounds like, let me just back up. So on this memory saccade task, the target will appear in the response field, but it will disappear. And the monkey will have to keep looking at the fixation point until it disappears. And then eventually, after it disappears, that's the monkey's cue to make a saccade into the remembered location of the target. So I'll play you a movie of that now, hopefully. Okay, so every time you heard a click, that was the response from a single isolated cortical neuron. And what I hope you could hear, I'll play the movie again, was that the neuron continues firing even after the target disappears. So now this is I'll play you now a trial where the target is in the opposite direction, and you'll hear that once the fixation point goes off, the neuron is very quiet. Okay, I'll play the other one more time. So this kind of persistent activity that's present even when the target is removed from the response field is, we think, really interesting. It's sort of divorced from sensory input. There's no longer a sensory input, but the neuron is still firing. And so we think that these neurons give the brain a sort of freedom from immediacy from sensory inputs and allow it to operate on a more flexible timescale. But of course, to really get at this issue of whether these neurons reflect the accumulation of evidence, we look at the response of the neurons when the monkey is engaged in the motion discrimination task that I've been telling you about. So we place one of the choice targets in the response field of a neuron under study, and the random dot motion is presented foveally. So remember, the random dots are not in the response field. When we look at the peristimulus time histograms, we align them to different events in the trial. So for example, these responses are aligned to the onset of the motion stimulus. So let me just tell you a little bit about what happens during these responses. First, we see a stereotype dip and recovery that isn't related to the monkey's eventual choice. And then after that, we see a gradual buildup of firing rate. The buildup is quite crisp for strong stimulus, and it's more sluggish for weaker stimuli. That's for the two-choice task. And it's this period in here, when the monkey is forming his decision but is not yet committed to a particular choice, that we think we see what's a neural signature of the bounded accumulation of evidence. So remember, in the plot I showed you before of the model, we would expect to see a ramp-like increase in firing rate that proceeds over the time that the monkey's making his decision. And indeed, that's exactly what we see. And the same is true for the four-choice task as well. You can see that during this time, the monkey's forming his decision, and we see a ramp-like increase in firing rate that's proportional to the strength of the stimulus. And it's because of these kinds of responses that we have argued for many years that, I'll take your question in just a sec, that these responses reflect the accumulation of random samples of evidence. So I'll be a bit more concrete about why we think that, and then invite some skepticism. Did you have a question?
Yeah, can you just tell us how the averaging was done?
Yeah, so no, for this one, I mean, we do it lots of different ways. For this particular plot, we call this the unconditionalized average. So I group the trials based on the motion direction, but I average together all possible outcomes. So for these, for the 9% motion strength stimulus, the monkeys make quite a few errors. So this reflects the average of both correct and incorrect trials. For this motion strength, it's also true that there are corrects and incorrects, but they make a rather smaller number of errors. So there are smaller numbers of errors in those trials. If you plot just the correct trials, the difference is just that the slope of this line is slightly higher for the weaker motion strengths. You mean, are they overlapping? No. There's still a very clear relationship between the slope of this line and the motion strength. It's a slightly weaker relationship, but it's still a very clear line. If we take a line, fit it to the data, and then plot the slope of that line as a function of motion strength, then it's a non-zero value, whether you compute that quantity with the conditionalized or unconditionalized data. Yeah? No, that's okay. We look for the cells that pass the memory-guided saccade task that I described before. So we put an electrode into the intraparietal sulcus, and we keep looking until we find neurons that have persistent activity during that delay that I showed you in the movie, right? So neurons that keep firing even when the target is removed from the response field. Oh, yeah. No, I don't know. It's very hard to tell, unfortunately, and it would be really nice to have that information. I think your question kind of highlights a shortcoming of doing these experiments in monkeys, which is that we go into an area and we sort of treat each neuron as if they were a proxy for every other neuron. And to a certain extent, that's a fairly reasonable approximation. It happens to be the case that in the ventral part of LIP, Lewis and Van Essen would call this LIPV, the neurons are pretty stereotyped. They almost all start firing at around 25 to 30 spikes per second, and around the time of the saccade are 68 spikes per second. They are actually super stereotyped, but it is a real frustration that we don't know more about the larger circuits of which these neurons are a part. Yeah.
How many cells can you sort of hit on a particular sort of way down?
Well, so we go through the, it sort of depends where in the sulcus you are, but I mean, sometimes we go through the lumen, right, and then hit the IPS on the other side of the lumen, and so it's highly variable, but this is on the order of 7 millimeters below the cortical surface, so it's, yes, pretty, I mean, I don't know if you consider that deep or not. I used to record in the cerebellum, so I don't, but depends where you're used to recording, I guess. Okay, any other questions? Yeah. I'm not sure what I know. If you mean in the firing rates of correct versus incorrect trials? Yeah, so this is really interesting. So there's a difference between between data sets in the lab. There's certainly not a big difference, and I'm pretty sure in my data set there's actually early on, I think there's no difference. So there's a difference around the time of the choice, there is, because around the time of the choice, the firing of the neurons is almost entirely determined on whether the monkey makes a choice to the choice target in the response field or out. But early on, I'm pretty sure that they're actually identical. Yeah.
Well, can you predict what the monkey's going to do from the firing of itself?
Perfectly. Yeah, around the time of the scotch. Around here, you totally can't. You can't. And I mean, it's if you look at the firing rate, 70 milliseconds before the monkey makes the saccade, which would be kind of hard, admittedly, to train your ear to do, so I shouldn't say perfectly. But if you look offline, I mean, it's just a massive difference between the two. And I'll show you that data later in the talk. So there's two different issues here. So 0%, there is no correct and incorrect, right? So you'd have to be sorting by the choice the monkey eventually made. But these are different times in the trial, right? So early in the trial, the responses are really similar because they're reflecting the accumulation of evidence, you know, or they're reflecting something that I'm suggesting is this particular mechanism. Later in the trial, they really only reflect the monkey's choice, and it doesn't matter whether it's two or four choice. It doesn't matter if it was high or low coherence. It doesn't matter, you know, if the monkey's having a bad day. They're always firing at, you know, 68 spikes per second if he's going to make a TN choice. So there's a real time-dependent evolution of the response over the course of the trial. Yeah? We haven't done that experiment. I think the closest that people have come to doing is doing different kinds of decision tasks that don't involve an eye movement response, but instead involve a hand movement response. And the story is kind of mixed. I would say for some of the data sets, what it looks like to me, I think the people who actually collect this data have a different interpretation, but what it looks like to me is that early on in the response, the LIP neurons are reflecting aspects of the stimulus. And then later in the response, later on in the trial, the responses, the firing rates just get really, really low. So it looks to my mind as if there's sort of decision-related activity in LIP early on, but then the response is kind of kicked out of LIP as the time of the movement approaches. I don't want to come down too strongly on that point of view, though. In our lab, we actually have collected a reaching version of this task in LIP, and the neurons actually do something really similar on reaching and eye movement versions, but it's really difficult to interpret because they're trained animals. I mean, the short answer is nobody's done the kind of experiment that you describe, and it would be interesting to see. I mean, you're certainly tapping into something critical, which is that part of the reason we see these responses has to do with the fact that this is an area that cares about certain parts of space because they're ultimately going to be the target of a movement. And I mean, you might sort of see that as a negative thing. I sort of see that as a real strength of this approach, is that we're taking this very complex task, and instead of asking, you know, what is this sort of abstract representation of this complex input, instead we're asking, what does the motor system want to do with this input, and how can we learn about decision making by asking how these incoming signals bear upon an impending movement? So I think I might not be super inclined to try that particular kind of task, because I think these neurons care a lot about movement, and I think, I think to my mind, I wouldn't really want to study them without movement. Yeah. Yeah, so nobody has ever done that. And I mean, LIP cares about the eye movements, and so my prediction would be that the closest anybody has ever come is Josh Gold, who does what he calls a red-green version of the task. So in this version of the task, the monkey doesn't know what he can't plan a movement because he doesn't know what the movement will be until these red and green targets appear, and that work is still kind of evolving. So yeah. Well, remember that the random dot motion is actually not placed in the response field. It's presented foveally, and the only thing that's in the response field is the target. So what the only thing that we can kind of report on is the sort of direction selectivity as it bears on an eye movement. I'm not sure if that's what you're, is that what you're asking, or you wondered about the random dot motion? Oh, yes, sorry, that's a really simple question. Yeah, hopefully I have data on that in this talk, but it does the opposite. So instead of the responses increasing, they decrease. Yeah. Yeah, they yes, the decrease on this particular data set is mitigated compared to other ones, but they do decrease. Yeah, it's either a much less dramatic increase like that, or depending on the motion strength, it's a decrease. So, yeah. Well, the way that I have plotted this, you can't really tell because I've cut off the responses 100 milliseconds or more before the saccade. You're right that you can't tell from this plot. It looks like I think maybe I'm going to hold off on your question because I think the data, the variance data really speaks to that more than the mean data, particularly aligned to this epoch in the trial. Yeah. Well, so once we get into the right part of LIP, they really all do. They're really all the same. And so, like, if we have a new animal and we're trying to find LIP, it can take a while to find the right place. And sometimes we'll find other parts of the interparietal sulcus where the responses, for example, are more visual. So they're sort of direction selective. They're very, you know, very spatially selective, but they respond more to the presentation of the choice target rather than to the movement itself. So sometimes we'll find areas like that. But once we get to the right area, all the neurons do the same thing, and then we just go to the same place. You know, it's usually, well, it's a small area. It's sort of 2 or 3 millimeters across. Yeah, so microstimulation experiments have been done both in area MT and also in area LIP, and the basic finding is similar in the two areas, which is that microstimulation affects the decision. To tell you exactly how is a slightly longer story, so I think I'm going to hold off on that, but if you're interested, and then ask me later for sure. Yeah?
What fraction of neurons show variable firing rate?
What do you mean, you mean?
So when you get monkeys make a saccade phase turn interaction.
Yeah. So you're wondering what the degree to which they're direction selective or the degree to which they have persistent firing on the memory saccade?
Keep the firing rate constant.
On the memory-guided saccade task, you mean? Yeah. Well, none of them keep it constant. Usually it drops about 40%, and then it stays at a constant level throughout the delay, and then the monkey makes a saccade. So I have seen very few neurons that maintain the entire, where the magnitude remains unchanged, suggesting that there's certainly a visual component to these responses. And yeah, that's quite in line in what we think about what they're doing. There's both a visual and an other component. I think, did you have a question? Well, I mean, I think one of the nice things about doing experiments with this kind of a very tightly controlled behavioral paradigm is we have a really nice readout about how the monkey's doing, right? And we can compare his behavior over time, and our standards for what we consider acceptable behavior are very, very high. When I first came to the lab, I was training a monkey to do an 8-choice version of the task, and I thought things were going great. I went to see Mike Shadlin, who was PI, and I said, oh, this is great. You know, he's at 95% correct. And Mike said, oh, 95% correct. It's a pathology. We have to abandon the task. We will never do this task again. You know, so we expect them to be, I'm saying this kind of as a joke, but I think this is really important, is that we want to be absolutely sure that the monkey is completely clear on the mapping between what happens in the stimulus and what he's supposed to do. And we have a way of telling that, which is looking at what he does at the highest stimulus strength. Is he absolutely perfect at the highest stimulus strength? And if he's not, something's wrong. And maybe it's that he has been ill-trained, or maybe there's something wrong in the brain. So we have a really careful readout about how he's doing. There's a deeper question about how does the training affect the responses, but that's sort of perhaps a longer thing than we have time for at the moment. Well, it depends, right? So, I mean, well, we usually, I mean, like, you know, this is a really technical point. I don't think this is really worth anybody's time. But, you know, we put these grids on the brain, and we usually go to the same two or three grid holes for like 6 months. And then we'll move it to another part of the cortex, and then move it to the other side and the other side. So yeah. Yeah. I'm struggling with this because in the simplest version, there's differences between different data sets on this particular topic. So I think on this, we haven't done that experiment, so I'm not going to comment on it. The closest we've come to that kind of a manipulation is as Alex Huck, who has added these kind of motion energy pulses that are sort of in the background of the dots, and he sees what the effect of these pulses and how long does it last. He sees that the effect of the pulses is very long lasting, and that's part of the reason why we think that the integration time of these neurons is very long. So yeah, this response is largely, not entirely, stimulus driven, and so if you change the stimulus, you're going to change the rate of ramp up. It depends. If you went from the highest motion strength to the highest motion strength in the opposite direction, it would probably decrease. But I mean, it depends on the neuron. It's right. Different motion strengths confer different buildup rates, but the degree to which they do is kind of, it depends on the cell. Yeah. Two monkeys per task. you guys are very interested in these very technical details. I trained two monkeys to do both two and four choice tasks. I collected data from both of them, both from LIP, and then collected data from the same two monkeys on the same two tasks of microstimulation in MT. So it's usually the N is two. It didn't take any time to train them to do the four choice task. They could do it immediately. Yeah, then they're used for a long time. But this is a side point. Let's not get bogged down on monkey, the rate at which we use monkeys in the Shadlin lab, because it's not really related to the scientific goals I hope to communicate to you. Okay, so I've told you about what the mean response is in the neurons. And I want to tell you now about predictions of neural variability that are inherent to this mechanism that I told you about now very long ago, thanks to that discussion. So this is the model that I proposed to you before, the bounded accumulation of evidence. And what I showed you before was this black line. And it was meant to reflect the average response of many individual trials. So the way that I generated these was just to sample pieces of momentary evidence from a Gaussian and add them all up together. So it's just about the simplest model you can imagine. And what I want to draw your attention to is, even though the mean of these traces is a somewhat linear response, each individual trial is not linear. It's the instantiation of a random walk, and that's what why I've made this one trace pink here, to make it clear that this individual trace itself is not at all linear. Okay, and so what I have tried to argue is that the ramp-like change in firing rate that we see in the data reflects the sum of many of those individual random walks, accumulation of random samples of evidence. Okay, but the truth is that you could probably envision quite a lot of other mechanisms that would generate trials that, when averaged together, resulted in a line that's increasing over time. So this isn't meant to reflect a real candidate model for decision making, but just sort of a simple toy example. This is a collection of trials. The slope is always the same, but they have a different offset. And if you average them all together, you'll get a line that's increasing over time, just like we see in the data. This is a slightly, perhaps, more realistic model. Here, I haven't added together pieces of random, random samples of evidence. Instead, I've sampled at each moment and added that sample to a deterministic line, so a line with some slope. And again, the average of many of these traces is some line that's increasing over time. So I'm going to put these, before I get there, but what I'd like to argue is that you could distinguish these mechanisms. You can't distinguish them based on the mean, right? The mean is always the same. It's some line that increases with some slope. But I would like to argue that you can distinguish them by looking at their variability over time. So this process, the bounded accumulation of evidence, the variability across the traces increases over time. Initially, the variability is very low because all of these traces are beginning at the same point, but it grows as time goes by. Okay? Hello? Okay, and so I'm going to quantify that by plotting the variance, which I'm calling the variance of the conditional expectation, that is the expectation of each of these lines, as a function of time. In fact, for this example, this is really just the variance. It's just the variance of these traces. You'll see why I'm calling it this var CE. You'll see why I'm calling it this in a moment. But I'm plotting that quantity as a function of time, and it's increasing over time because the variability is growing as time goes by. And I've drawn these as if there were no bound, because the bound obviously makes things a lot more complicated. Go ahead. The stimulus is I'm sampling numbers from a Gaussian, so it's always the same Gaussian, and I'm just adding them together.
Do you repeat exactly the same thing from the side, or do you make
new? Are you talking about in the lab or to generate the simulation?
No, it's
obviously not the same one for every trial, right? So in each trial, I pick some number of numbers, say 100, and then take the cumulative sum of those. And then on the next trial, to generate the next trace, then I pick 100 different randomly sampled numbers and add all of them together. So I'm just adding together random samples of evidence. These are just random walks.
This is not data, right?
No. This is a simulation. Yeah, it's a simulation. Yeah. No, we don't share the same stimulus from trial to trial. No.
Yeah.
So then at each moment, I've taken the variance across these traces. And this, I mean, there's no way that this could be in neural data. And this is a really important point that I'm going to harp on again in a moment. In real data, of course, we don't ever have access to the analog quantity that these are meant to represent on each trial. What we get on each trial is a list of spike times. That's all we have. So we don't ever get access to this. We can only have this kind of plot if we simulate them on MATLAB, because we don't. All we get is a list of spike times. You could potentially. What did you say? Oh, you can, but there are all kinds of problems in doing that, right? You can't be sure that, for a number of reasons, right? So, we'll come to that. Okay. So this second mechanism here, certainly there is variability across the different traces, but the variability is always the same. It doesn't grow as time goes by. So the var CE for this mechanism is non-zero, but it's stationary over time. It doesn't grow over time. And for this mechanism here, this additive noise mechanism, again, there's clearly lots of variability, but it doesn't get larger as time goes by because the pieces of evidence aren't being summed together. So again, there is some non-zero var CE, but it doesn't increase over time. Okay, so if the responses that we see in the data really reflect the accumulation of random samples of evidence, we should be able to see a neural signature of that mechanism by looking at the variability that's present in the data. But there's a warning here, it might appear, that there's trouble ahead, because as I said a moment ago, we don't actually have access to the quantities that I've illustrated there. We don't ever have an analog readout of what happens on each trial in the data. Instead, we just have a list of spike times. And the problem is even greater than that, because the variability that we see in those spike times doesn't just represent or reflect the variance of the conditional expectation, that is, this interesting source of variability that can be informative about neural mechanism. It also contains variance that reflects the fact that we're sampling a point process, right? That the neurons are stochastic and have a variable rate from trial to trial, even when we give the same stimulus on each instantiation. So the way that we do that is as follows. So here are a bunch of toy examples. These are the three that I showed before. I'm going to start with this one here. To generate this simulation, I have some time-varying rate, except on this simplest example, it's not even time-varying rate, a stationary rate. It's the same on every trial. And I just convert it into convert this intensity command into spikes using different kinds of MATLAB functions. For example, this is computed using plusrand.m, which I'll mention again, and you'll see why I'm mentioning it. Same on every trial. There's still a lot of trial-to-trial variability, simply because I've added this second probabilistic step. And so the quantity of the variance that we're interested in is not the point process variance. We want to get rid of that. And this is a problem that many people have grappled with, right? This is typically why people plot the Fano factor. But I'm going to suggest today a rather different measure that's, I think, more principled than the Fano factor and gets around some major flaws of the Fano factor that can cause that particular measure to give very misleading estimates of variability. So this quantity here is meant to be the total measured variance. So that's just the total spike count variance in a bin of some particular size. And by the law of total variances, that's the sum of the variance of the conditional expectation, that is the variance across the different intensity commands from trial to trial, plus the point process variance, the variance that is introduced by the fact that I added this extra probabilistic step. Okay, so when we do this in a simulation, it's really easy, right? Because, so I've just rearranged this equation. The VCE is now over here, and we use S to, S means our measured estimate of this idealized quantity here. So to get this, the VCE, we simply take the difference of the total measured variance here and the point process variance. And in a simulation, it's really easy to do that, right? Because we know what the point process variance is. If we use a particular, say, MATLAB function to generate the variance, if we use a Poisson function, for example, we know that the variance is equal to the mean. So we can estimate this point process variance simply by subtracting off the mean spike count here. And this would be equivalent to having a measured Fano factor of 1. Okay, so by doing that, for each of these examples, we can compute this quantity, the VARCE, and it's the same, it's identical in magnitude and shape and everything to the VARCE that I showed you a moment ago, because this, this series of steps allows us to reconstruct from the total spike count variance the component of variance that's informative about neural mechanism, which is the VARCE, the variance of the conditional expectation. Okay, so here, I hope you can see this, these four different kind of toy mechanisms, we don't expect the VARCE to increase over time, and indeed it doesn't, whereas here, the bounded accumulation, the VARCE increases over time. And that we can recover that even when that quantity is computed from the spike trains. Okay, so I'm going to use that same approach in the data. And the data, of course, it's trickier because we don't know what this constant phi is, but we'll talk about that. What did you say? We don't know that for sure, but I think there's reasonably good evidence to suggest that it is, right? So we don't know what the value of phi is, but we can look at situations where we think that phi is going to be constant. Okay, we won't know its magnitude, but we think that it's constant, and ask, is there a constant ratio of variance to mean? And that's, for example, like in Giesel and Albrecht, 1995, and in John Monsell's earlier paper. McAdams and Monsell have done those calculations and see a roughly constant ratio of variance to mean. That doesn't mean that you always expect to see that as constant, right? Because the measured Fano factor includes not only the point process variance, but this other quantity as well. So if you're thinking, well, gosh, I've seen that the measured Fano factor does vary with the mean, then that's not necessarily evidence against this, right? Because there are only particular circumstances in which you'd expect there to be a constant ratio between the two. And when you look at those examples, you do see a fairly constant ratio. So I think that's a defensible assumption. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true.
Okay, so that could be a collective integration, a bunch of them. So you can have access to the part of all those neurons. You might not need to do any estimation of the stochastic ability, but just add up the spikes, or something like spike frequency for the very small, spike number for the very small bit, and then you would plot that and you would see perfect.
Yeah, I think if you were able to record from lots of neurons at once, then you could get around this problem. Because, for example, I guess I'm not sure which alternative mechanism you have in mind, but yes, I agree with you. That would be one way to get around that. In practice, doing that in this kind of a task is really difficult to do, because the problem is that the task has to be configured based on the properties of the response field of the neuron from which we're recording, right? So for example, we need to have a neuron, we would need to record from a bunch of neurons that were either in or not in, you know, in or opposite to the response field of the neuron under study, and have a whole bunch of those, which is just tricky to do, right? I mean, if you have different electrodes, because of the topography, you're probably not gonna have response fields in the same places, and that would be a better way of getting at it, but it's quite technically a difficult thing to do that nobody has done yet. So I think that this is a way of getting at it from single neuron responses.
Right, so basically it's better, so because you cannot report from a bunch of neurons that are relevant to integration, you have to do this indirectly by simulating the stochastic process.
Yeah, so I'm not going to simulate the stochastic process in the actual neurons. Let me show you what I did. Yeah, I did that simulation to sort of make it clear why we have developed this measure, the VAR-CE, and how we compute it. So let me just tell you what we do in real data. Okay, so these are the mean firing rates. I showed you this before. We get these means by making a peristimulus time histogram. And the way that we do that is to take some sliding window and count up the number of spikes in each window, at each moment in time. And that gives us a vector of spike counts. And then the variance of that vector is the total measured spike count variance. I probably should be calling this S now, since S is supposed to be measured one. But anyway, sigma squared of N. And to eliminate the component of variance that is uninformative about neural mechanism, we subtract off the point process variance. And we can estimate that by multiplying this constant phi, which we can talk about, by the mean spike count. Okay? And so if we knew that this was a Poisson process, then phi would just be 1, and we would be subtracting off the mean spike count, because if that were the case, the point process variance would be equivalent to the mean. But instead, we have to estimate phi. Yeah. Yeah, we do this at each time. So that's what the there's no I. Yes, I think there is a time. Yeah, so there should be we usually call time I. So there should be a little I on each of these. So we do this at each moment in time, and then we can see how that evolves over time and see whether it increases. Yeah. Yeah. The neuron still, it doesn't look that different. Yeah. And so the reason for that is probably that some of the total spike count variance is coming from the stimulus. But a lot of it, even when the stimulus is the same from trial to trial, remember that the LIP neurons are listening to spikes from MT neurons. They're listening to spikes from V1 neurons. And so this point process variance is kind of getting accumulated from layer to layer. So even when you show the same stimulus on every single trial, you wouldn't expect to have the identical input on LIP from trial to trial because of the point process variance that it has sort of inherited from the areas that are driving it. The behavior is still stochastic. It's not a big difference between this. These experiments were done a long time ago, and there's just not a big difference in the behavior. And we typically collect, you know, we have like 10% of our trials have the same random seed, so we can compare the behavior, and it doesn't have that much of an impact. I mean, it depends, right? So you might happen to pick a random seed. So, I mean, the stimulus is stochastic, right? So you expect to have some moments where there is some motion energy in some direction or another. So it might be that if you pick some random seed, you happen to get motion energy that's a little bit more to the right than it is to the left. And if that's the case, if you go back and compute the motion energy for all the trials where the monkey chose right versus the ones where he chose left, for example, then you do see a difference in the average motion energy preceding each of those trials. So it isn't as if the stimulus isn't informing the choice. It's just that in addition to the stimulus variability, there's a whopping component of variability added on top of that. Yeah. You mean the same one from trial to trial? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yes.
Other possibility is
Yeah. Those are all, I think that's almost the kind of way that I'm trying to partition the variance, right? I don't want to come down too hard on the idea that LIP neurons are actually doing the integration, because it might be that the information's integrated elsewhere, but I'll just be sort of sloppy with words for a moment. I think the inherited variance, that is the variance of the conditional expectation, the idea that there's some different intensity command from trial to trial. And that additional variance, the point process variance, we don't know entirely which components are contributing to it. It could be just the spike generation mechanisms. Maybe it's also coming from the integration. We don't have a lot of ideas about where these long integration time constants come from, so it's sort of hard to speculate. But yeah, what did you say? Oh yeah, no, it's getting lots of input. Yeah. Yeah, that's in the anesthetize. Yeah. Yeah, so, but I mean, even in that case, right, there's still a lot of trial-to-trial variability in MT, even when the image runs. No, this is not an anesthetize. So even if you have an anesthetized animal. Yeah. You mean in the awake? Yeah, so certainly some of the variability comes from the fact that the eyes are moving around and changing the stimulus, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's coming from a lot of different sources. And I don't mean to imply that we know what the source of that trial-to-trial variability is. We don't. It's coming from a lot of things. True, but you wouldn't necessarily... What, say that again? I thought you were saying one thing, and now I'm not sure. Yes. But I think maybe you're thinking I'm making a stronger point than I really am, right? I'm not trying to say that all sources of variance that are not captured by the point process variance are arising from trial-to-trial differences in the stimulus. Some of them probably are, and some of them are arising from different things. Yeah. I'm not sure... Yeah, so I definitely agree with you. I guess I'm not sure why you think that's relevant to this particular discussion. I think, you mean because we would know more what the variability was from trial to trial?
I guess I'm saying these questions go to my...
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that stimulus has a number of shortcomings, and I'm... not intending to use it, but I mean, for this particular purpose, I think it would be a mistake to think that that this is sort of the wrong stimulus in which to use neural variability as a way to get at neural mechanism. It's really not. It's a stimulus that's different from trial to trial, and we expect the variance to do something very specific because it's different from trial to trial, and where exactly that variability is arising from is in a sense somewhat tangential. So I think, although there are many shortcomings of the dot stimulus, I don't think that they're massively relevant to the conclusions I want to make today. So let's move on. Okay, so this is, again, I've replotted the firing rate here as a function of time. This is averaged across all different motion strengths, which is why it's not increasing. And down here, I've plotted this quantity, the variance of the conditional expectation, as a function of time. And these are responses that are aligned to the onset of stimulus motion. And what I hope you can see is that when the stimulus motion comes on, the neurons become a bit less variable. Hang on, Peter. Their variability decreases, and then it increases gradually over quite a long period of time. And I think there might be a temptation at this point to think, well, any old neural mechanism, you're always going to see variance increasing over the time, monkeys doing all kinds of crazy stuff. In fact, seeing a variability increase over time is very, very unusual in the brain. And so this is a figure from Mark Churchland's paper showing a quantity that's very similar to what we have measured. It's called the mean matched Fano factor. It's similar in a lot of ways. And this is data from V1, MT, LIP, PMD, orbital frontal cortex, parietal reach region, and MT and V4. And in every single one of these areas, as soon as the animal engages in a task, there's a big decrease in variability. That's true everywhere. Okay? So seeing an increase in variability as time goes by, as we have seen here, is very unusual in the brain. And I think it is for that reason that I want to argue that this increase in VAR-CE is a hallmark of this particular neural mechanism. Yeah? Say that again? Yeah. Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, in the visual areas, it probably is, certainly in V4 and MT. In PMD, it's a little harder to say, right, because it's more of a motor planning area. And so they've argued that the decrease in variability there has to do more with settling into a motor plan, which is probably not quite the same as the sensory phenomenon that you're describing. Possible, yeah. I mean, they have a really different interpretation, which is that sort of that the monkey is in any. Well, this is maybe more similar to your sensory interpretation. That in advance of the trial, the brain is in any of a number of different states, and the engaging in a trial kind of quenches that and moves the brain into a similar state. And that's a more kind of parsimonious explanation that fits with both the more motor areas and the more sensory areas. Yeah. Which the this slide here, you mean? But why would changes in gain have an effect on variance, though? Right? I mean. This is, I agree that would explain changes in mean, but this is variance.
A low variable component is the stimulus, and the high variable component, which is the noise or a lower level is the noise.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, no, I mean... Sure. I mean, the reason that I wanted to put this up is to make the point that seeing an increase in variability when an animal engages in a task is not by any means a foregone conclusion. And there might be a lot of sort of spurious reasons why one might think that it would be. For example, you know, the trajectories become more variable over time, you know, different kinds of things. And I'm including this plot only to argue that it's not a certainty to see an increase. In fact, it's very unusual, perhaps because the mechanisms that you describe are very prevalent. But I don't really want to take a stand on what the explanation is for this particular phenomenon, because this is not my work. Yeah, so gain ramping up. I don't know, maybe we should talk more about this mechanism either, because I'm not sure I quite see the relationship between gain and variance, particularly because we don't think that this has any, is related to changes in mean firing rate. Yeah, okay, so I'm glad you brought up the Fano factor. So, actually, I can answer both questions with the same plot, I think. So the Fano factor, yeah, let me find it. Okay, well, this may have been a misguided idea. I can't really see where my scroll bar is. Okay, you know what? This is a bad idea. I'm going to go back. And I'll draw it for you on the board. Okay, so the trouble with the fan, so it, the short answer is that if you perhaps are skeptical about the results because the measurement that we're using is different from the Fano factor, you certainly needn't be. And I'll show you the plot at the end. It's just at the end of the stack. The Fano factor has the same behavior. It increases over time. I really don't like to use the Fano factor for the following reason. I hope you can see this. So if you... No? Oh, okay. sorry, I didn't mean to erase your dinner thing. Okay, so if you believe this idea that the total measured spike count variance is the sum of the variance of the conditional expectation, put eyes there for Peter. I don't know if you guys can see, probably not. Plus the expectation of the conditional variance, then what you do with the Fano factor is that you just divide each of these quantities by the mean spike count, right? Which I'm calling n sub I. Okay, so over here, this is fine. This is just the total. This is phi. Okay, this is the point process variance divided by the spike count. But this is the var CE, right? Okay, and so in the Fano factor, you're taking the var CE, the quantity that you care about, and normalizing it by mean spike count. And if you are happen to be in some regime where there's no time varying firing rate, then that's fine. You're just going to scale that quantity and it's not going to matter. But in a case like this, when firing rates are changing as a function of time, then you'll end up scaling the very quantity that you care about by some number that's changing over time. So I can present to you an example. This is the same one that I showed before. So this is meant to be the mean. Hopefully you remember this from before. These purple lines are meant to be the firing rates on individual trials. So if we compute the Fano factor for this quantity, then you're going to get a Fano factor that's decreasing over time because you're dividing, you're normalizing the variance of the conditional expectation by some time-varying quantity. So if you have a situation like this, you can be misled into thinking that the neuron is perhaps becoming more regular when in fact it's really just because you're normalizing by a quantity that you really shouldn't be normalizing. So that's why I think that this is a much more principled approach than using the Fano factor. That's the way that we get phi is basically by looking at the point in the trial where the measured ratio of variance to mean is the lowest. So the reason we do that is as follows. So suppose, let me back up. Okay, so suppose that, as a first estimate, you thought that, okay, maybe phi is 1. Maybe neurons are really Poisson. So then you subtract from the total spike count variance the number 1 times the mean spike count. If you do that in the neural data, and I'll show you that slide when I get there, then you'll get some quantity that's much less than 0, which doesn't make sense, right? The total variance can never be less than 0, so it doesn't make sense. So that will sort of tip you off that clearly the number that you've chosen is too big. And if you keep progressively going to smaller and smaller numbers, eventually you will get some number that prevents the var CE from ever being negative. And that number is an upper bound on phi. And that number is also equivalent to the minimum of the Fano factor, the measured Fano factor across the course of the trial. So we don't know what phi is. We have an upper bound on phi. And I'll show you, if I ever get to those slides, well, hang on, let me finish, whether the degree to which these results are dependent on particular values of phi, because it's really, really important. That's really kind of the linchpin of the analysis, is knowing that number. Oh, okay. Wait, Richard. No, sorry. We plot this. We plot the total measured variance. Yes. Right, because if you pick some number that's not the minimum, then at some point you're going to have a var CE that's negative. Right, just think about it.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, sorry, that was totally rude. Yeah, go ahead. Are you talking about the decrease in which? Are you talking about the dip? What decrease in rates are you talking about? Well, no, we use the same value of phi throughout, right? So the variability decreases and then increases after that, and we pick one phi for each neuron and use that throughout the course of the trial. At some point, there's no numbers on the ordinate here, but you would never see it on this plot. Let me keep going, okay? Because the point in the trial where the Fano factor happens to be the lowest is right when the targets come on and at the time of the saccade, which makes sense, right? So this is during decision formation. It is. This is motion onset, not target onset. I'll keep going because the target onset I think is next. Okay, so yeah, just briefly, we see the same increase in VAR-CE for just 0% motion strength trials, or whether we compute it for all trials together. We also computed the VAR-CE separately for 2 and 4 choice trials. And this, I mentioned this only because it sort of helped us to understand a difference that we'd observed between 2 and 4 choice trials that I won't in the end have time to tell you too much about today. But interestingly, the VAR-CE rises in a very, very similar way for 2 and 4 choice, suggesting that evidence is accumulated very similarly for those two different trials, and suggests that the differences that we see in firing rate are not related to the way that evidence is accumulated, but perhaps related to strategic differences on 2 versus 4 choice versions of the task, which is something that we had postulated previously. Say that again? I think the reverse is true, right? I think that because there is a different random walk from trial to trial, that we in the input, yeah, that we expect there to be a change in a trial to trial variance that increases over time.
But that would also be true if you didn't give a variable stimulus, if you gave lower contrast or something like that. That's what you do, right?
So say that again, if I.
If you didn't use a random stimulus, if you use exactly
right. I think you would see a VAR-CE that was non-zero, but I don't think you would expect it to be increasing over time. Because I think what's key about this is that because the random samples of evidence are added together, then the difference between trials grows over time. And if you had some stimulus that was stationary with respect to time, you would expect there to be a non-zero VCE, VAR-CE, but you wouldn't expect it to grow as a function of time. So I definitely think it's... Yeah. Yeah. Well, then aren't you then surprised? But then aren't you surprised about all these other tasks in every other area in the brain where the VAR-CE doesn't grow?
They're not adding up evidence, are they?
Yeah, so I mean, it depends what you mean. If it's any kind of task that's causing an animal to add up random samples, I definitely agree. And I certainly don't think the random dots are the only, or certainly even the best one. I agree with you to test that. But yeah.
But if you have exact the same stimulus, mm-hmm. it's going through so many levels. Of
yes.
It's going to be giving up
yes.
the process. So I don't think it's the, I wouldn't argue that it's the random.
I mean, I think if you were making a judgment about, but I mean, I'm not entirely sure I understand your question, so we should maybe come back to this, but I think there are lots of kinds of decision tasks where you're making judgments about ambiguous evidence for which you would predict this result. But I don't think you predicted if, for example, you were just, you know, looking at some stimulus. Okay.
I was just saying that this doesn't really depend on the
question.
Yes. It doesn't really depend on the fact that you're using random dots. Any kind of stimulus that was hard, but it was
yes.
fast.
Yes.
Where it wasn't immediately obvious, you'd have to
accumulate.
Then you get the same result.
That's yes, exactly. I completely agree. Yeah, I think I misunderstood you before. Okay, so I want to go on to talk about what happens on the target onset, so hold off that question for just a second, because this ends up being related to phi. Okay, so. So I've gone back a bit in time from the point of view of the trial. This is the moment when the choice targets have appeared, but the motion stimulus is not yet on. So the monkey knows whether he's in a 2 or 4 choice task, but he doesn't yet know anything about the quality of the evidence about which he's going to make a decision. He's just looking at the choice targets. So when this happens, we see a big increase in firing rate that then kind of peters out. And the VAR-CE during this time, this is for just the 4 choice task, undergoes a dramatic decrease that from which it then sort of recovers. And what did you say? And this decrease in VAR-CE is quite reminiscent of the decrease in variability that's been reported in other studies. So perhaps this is not surprising. What ended up being really interesting to us was that we saw a difference in the VAR-CE for the 2-choice versus 4-choice trials. So we knew previously that there was a difference in firing rate. So at the very beginning of the trial, we knew already that when there are 4 choice targets, the response is lower than it is when only 2 choice targets are present. And previously, we'd had what I think was kind of the wrong idea about this. We thought maybe this has to do, you know, with the monkey's expectation, probability of reward, something that had been reported in previous studies in the superior colliculus. But when we looked at this variability, the VERCE associated with those two targets, we then, you know, wondered if perhaps we should reevaluate our explanation for this effect. This suggests instead that on the four choice trials, this average reflects the mixture of a greater number of states. Perhaps because the monkey has his attention a little bit drawn to one of four instead of one of two targets. You know, we don't really know why. That's one possible explanation. But it ruled out certainly simpler mechanisms having to do with probability of reward, which would not, at least via a simple mechanism, predict different amounts of variability in the two conditions. They all come out at the same time. So it's possible. We thought about that a lot. Mostly, LIP neurons doesn't look like they have really a suppressive surround. And also, well, when people have looked, you know, in a more precise way, sort of mapping the response field. I mean, this is in the context of a decision task, right? So this isn't quite the right way to do it. But in any event, a better way of getting at that is by looking at neurons that happen to have a response field that's big enough so that the orthogonal targets are actually in the response field, so they can't be in any suppressive surround because they're actually in the response field. They actually excite the neuron. And even for that small subset of neurons, we still see a lower response on the four-choice task compared to the two-choice task. So it seems... Yeah, I mean, when people have looked in other contexts to look for suppressive surround in LIP, they haven't found it. It's possible all those studies were wrong. What? Yeah, I mean, that'd be the way to do it for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So it looks like in the four-choice task, in a way, it's not really the best task to kind of get at that issue because there are only two additional targets and they are 90 degrees away, which is sort of the bandwidth of most MT neurons. So in fact, what we see on the four-choice task, just to be descriptive, is that we call them the T90 targets, the targets that are 90 degrees away from the preferred direction, is that they don't depend on motion strength. So we see the exact same response, whether the monkey's presented with the highest, most salient stimulus ever or completely random motion. I did collect some data on an eight-choice task. However, you should take it with a big grain of salt because the monkey only got to 95% correct. And what I found on that is that the neurons that were intermediate to that, that were at 45 degrees, sort of looked like they were sort of intermediate between the two. They were motion strength dependent, but more that dependence was weaker than for neurons where the target was in the response field. So it looks like there's some big sort of population bump. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. So I have a figure of that. I'll show it to you. For this particular effect, it's dependent on phi. And I'm guessing that what you're wondering is that because the firing rate is higher for two-choice than four-choice, that the total measured spike count variance is higher for two-choice than four, which it is. And so obviously, for some value of phi, there's going to be a crossover. Okay. So the way that I've shown that is this is just the mean firing rate again. And this is VERCE. And I've plotted both two and four choice, red and blue, indicate the number of choices for a bunch of different values of phi, which are indicated by line style. So up here, phi is zero. So this is just the total measured spike count variance. And you can see that there's more variance for two choice compared to four choice. Okay, over here, this is the opposite extreme, where phi is some value that's larger than we think it really is, 0.6. And in this case, you see that there's much more VERCE for two choice than compared to four choice. So this was the reason I included this plot is because this is the effect that is most dependent on phi of all the different times that we measured. And the crossover, the value of phi for which you start to see a larger value for four choice than for two choice, it's on the order of about 0.27 or 0.28. And we have done that in a quantitative way by doing a comparison of the value and the standard error, which we compute by bootstrapping for different values of phi at different, for comparing between 2 and 4 choice. So, I mean, it might be the case that the value of phi really is some very small number, some number smaller than 0.28, in which case the effect that I've reported is not correct. I think 0.28 is probably pretty low. I would be surprised if the stochastic variability of the neurons was really on the order of 0.28. I think other kinds of reasonable assumptions put it more in the ballpark of kind of 0.4 to 0.6. Yeah, so the trouble is that you can, there are two, yeah, it's a real problem. There are two things you can do. You can get an upper bound on phi by going through the sort of exercise that I just described to you, and you can convince yourself that phi is proportional to mean firing rate by, for example, looking at time periods where you don't expect there to be zero var CE, but you expect var CE to be constant. Sorry, that the total spike count, that the PPV is proportional. Yeah, thank you. To mean spike count variance. But yeah, I mean, it's you can't. There's no experiment that you can really do to get at that issue. I mean, if you happen to have a data set where there's a lot of time varying firing rates, you can get some estimate of phi, and you can test whether your conclusions, as we've done here, are robust values of phi that are within a reasonable range. But there are going to be certain data sets that are not suitable for this kind of analysis because either they're not time varying, which actually there are other analyses you can do to get at this for that kind of a data set. Or, for example, you have reason to think that phi is changing because they have bursting, something like that. Yeah, did you have a question, Peter? But you'd still expect those to reflect the var CE as well, though. Why would you expect that just to reflect?
Yeah. If you control it, you can change the firing frequency by injecting current in very certain times, so you could figure that out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you could also look at the synaptic noise and see how that changes the time during the
Well, that's an interesting idea.
And the variance will just get bigger and louder.
I hadn't thought of that. It's an interesting idea. Yeah. Okay. So far I've told you about variability around the when the choice targets first come on, and then also at the time that the monkey is forming his decision. And now finally, I'll tell you what the var CE does around the time that the monkey makes his choice, around the time of the saccade. So what we knew already is that the responses that diverge as a function of motion strength early on in the trial coalesce to a more or less common firing rate about 70 milliseconds before the saccade. So we sort of knew in some sense that the variance decreased around the time of the saccade, but we hadn't done a careful analysis of the kind that I've told you about throughout this talk. We also had observed a difference between the responses that end to a choice target that's in the response field of the neuron understudy versus trials that end in the opposite, the target that's in the opposite direction. And excuse me, I think someone asked about this earlier. These are the responses of trials that go to the other direction. And one thing we had kind of observed, just kind of qualitatively, we've kind of known for a while, is that the responses here are a lot tighter for the T-in target than they are for the T out target. And we had sort of postulated that perhaps this arises because it's these neurons here that terminate the process, whereas these ones are kind of along for the ride and get caught in a number of different states depending on when the decision is terminated. So to get at that more carefully, we measured the same quantity, the var CE, around the time of the choice. So this is the average response to a whole bunch of all the T in trials and all the T out trials. This is about 15,000 trials each, so it's a lot of data. And then this is the var CE, and you can see that for both T in and T out, there's a big decrease in variance that takes place around the time of the saccade. And that's, again, perhaps in keeping with the observations that have been made in dorsal premotor cortex about the time-dependent pattern of variability as it relates to motor preparation. But what's really interesting is this difference between T in and T out responses. So the decrease in T in responses is sooner, and it's a much more dramatic decline, whereas the T out responses remain elevated a little bit longer and then decline later on, consistent with the idea that they only become stereotyped once the T in processes, the processes relating to a choice in the response field, are terminating the process. And I think I have a figure. Oh, so this is similar for 2 and 4 choice. And this is to show you the degree to which that's, that decrease in firing, decrease in VAR-CE is dependent on phi. So this is the same style of plot that I've showed you before, except now we're not comparing 2 versus 4 choice. This is just all the t-in, VAR-CE for all the t-in choices at different values of phi. So this is when phi is 0, that's the total spike count variance, and then these are different values of phi. So you can see for most reasonable values of phi, there's a pretty clear decrease in VAR-CE. Before the time of the saccade. And so we think this is, again, really in keeping with the mechanism that I proposed at the beginning of the talk, which is that there's a bound that terminates the process, and that that bound is reached by the firing rates of neurons that correspond to the target inside the response field. So I think I'm kind of out of time, which is kind of unfortunate, because I have this whole other section about correlations. I have 5 minutes? Okay. All right, well, I'll fly through this. So I've told you about this quantity that we've developed and used because we think it's informative about neural mechanism, and we have hoped that it would help us to distinguish various kinds of neural mechanisms and give support to the idea that these neurons are reflecting the accumulation of random samples of evidence. But in fact, there are a number of different candidates for decision making, that candidate models for decision making, that also produce an increase in the VAR-CE. Okay, I don't quite know why that's there. Okay, so this is the one I told you about before. So this is a model that has been championed by Paul Chizik and Jochen Diederich. This is called time-dependent scaling, and the idea is that random samples of evidence are not added together, but instead they're used to scale some kind of time-dependent urgency signal. So rather than adding them up, it's multiplicative scaling. Time-dependent scaling. And this is another model, which is called a Carpenter model. The idea is that there's no random accumulation of random samples of evidence. Instead, there's one value, one slope for that describes the entire trial that is present throughout the trial. And so if you know the slope for any moment, then you know it for the whole trial, but that slope differs from trial to trial. No, because you still expect performance to improve, right? Because if you wait longer, you have accumulated more evidence. No, you're not ignoring the evidence. I mean, I'm not sure what you're proposing, right? I mean, you. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if the animal had access to what that slope was, I grant you he wouldn't need to wait. But I think the idea is that the animal would only have access to what the firing rate was, and so over time the firing rate is getting closer to some bound. In any case, there are multiple problems with both of these models that we could argue about for days. I'm in full agreement with you, believe me. But they have been in the field for a while and have been kind of bugaboos that we haven't really been able to rule out because they make the same prediction for the mean. And, you know, and people who champion these models see our time-dependent rise and say, you know, it's ill-informed to insist that these reflect the random samples of evidence because, in fact, there are lots of other mechanisms that would lead to the same time-dependent pattern. And in fact, we had initially hoped that we could rule out these models by looking at the VAR-CE, but without going through why exactly this is, it's probably obvious to you if you think about it. They do both these other mechanisms do produce an increase in the VAR-CE. In fact, the increase is of a different shape, but it's difficult to really rule out these models based on the VAR-CE. It's noisy in the data. We don't have that much confidence about whether a rise is, in fact, linear. So we wanted to go one more step. And I'll go through this really quickly. These three mechanisms make very different predictions about the time-dependent correlation. So what we do is, for this model, I should probably back up one, for bounded accumulation, if you know the value on some particular trial, then you have some knowledge about what subsequent values will be, because each value is the sum of every value, of every other. Each number is the sum of all the numbers that preceded it. So the firing rate at each moment is correlated in a very particular way to the previous firing rates. Okay, and I've shown that in this matrix here, where each, so this is a heat plot, where one, these are all ones down the main diagonal, where each value reflects the correlation of the two times. So this is the correlation between the firing rate at time one and time two. Okay, so this is a really different kind of pattern than you'd expect from time-dependent scaling. Here you don't expect to see any correlation from moment to moment because the random samples of evidence are simply scaling some time-dependent increase. And so you don't expect there to be any correlation from moment to moment. Here with the Carpenter model, the reverse is true. If you know the firing rate at any moment, you know the firing rate at every other moment, because it's all determined by one slope. So they predict really different values for the correlation. So
this is spike count correlation.
Yep. The way that I have computed these was based on these analog traces, so I did have to deal for this simulation with, yeah, so in the data, though, it's the same deal, right? So in the data, this is going to be the same simulation of the sort that I've done before to tell you how I computed this in the data, and in 45 seconds, I'll tell you the answer. So we measure the spike counts in different windows, and we correlate the spike counts. We start by generating the covariance, but the trouble is that if we then compute the correlation from the covariance in the ordinary way by normalizing by the product of each of the relevant main diagonal, then we get correlations that are very weak, and we know from the model that there are supposed to be correlations present here, but this is just a simulation. The trouble is that the quantities along the main diagonal of the covariance matrix reflect both the VAR-CE and the PPV, whereas in this simulation, the off diagonals only reflect the VAR-CE, because the point process variance doesn't have a long time constant. It's the spikes are generated separately at each moment. So then we correct the covariance matrix by subtracting off the PPV from the main diagonal, and then we can compute the correlation. And then you can see the structure that's evident. And this was computed from a relatively small number of trials. You need a lot of trials to do this. It's a really noisy measurement. Yeah, sorry, I compute the VAR-CE in the ordinary way. So subtract off phi times the PPV. And this provides an additional constraint on the PPV, right? If you've picked the wrong PPV, then you end up with, pick the wrong value of phi, then your point process variance is elevated or inflated, and you can get correlations that are larger than one. So this is another way that you can constrain your phi. If you happen to have picked a phi that's incorrect, then there'll be a signature of that in the correlation. And we call this the correlation of the conditional expectation, or CORE-CE. And this is the different predictions. I told you this already, of CORE-CE for the different mechanisms. And this is what it looks like in the data. So it looks really similar to the kinds of correlations that you'd expect from bounded accumulation mechanisms. So we think that this distinguishes these models that we've been having a difficult time ruling out because they make really similar predictions for firing rate mean. So I'm going to conclude there. Oh, this is a whole other thing about different models I'm going to skip. So I hope that you'll take home from this is that there's a lot of information in the variance that's informative about neural mechanism. So I've sort of tried to summarize this by saying that the VAR-CE and the CORE-CE, the correlation of the conditional expectation, are useful tools. They capture the variation in what is computed and expose, at least in this data set, features of neural computations in decision making. For example, integration, mixtures, termination bound, and refute several models that make identical predictions for firing rate means. As I think we all agree, the main limitation is in estimating phi. There are some data sets where it's relatively straightforward to do that. There are other ones where it's not so straightforward. And that's definitely a challenge of this approach. So thank you all very much. And I'll be happy to take any more questions if you have them. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I mean, I guess I'm not sure how I understand how that's different from what we did, right? So like, did we compare the predictions for an integrator quantitatively with what we actually observed? Because you're right. I mean, there is a really simple analytical solution for what you'd expect. Yeah, they're really similar. I don't think I have the figure here, but I'll show it to you as soon as we're done. It's in my paper. Right, but you can tell that from the heat plot, right?
Yeah, but that's assuming.
Okay. Right. Isn't the fact that the rate is time varying though going to make that a difficult approach?
If it's finding noise, it's going to be able to cause control.
Yeah, so that, so basically you're describing like the temporal autocorrelation. Yeah, so I have done that. And I'm, so the way that I did that is I sort of sub-selected the data for conditions where the firing rate didn't vary a lot, because I think if the firing rate is time varying, I think that totally messes up that approach, but although maybe that's wrong. But in any case, the way I did it was to sub-select the data so that I used, you know, maybe I still had probably 18,000 trials, so it's a lot of data, and compute the temporal autocorrelation, and it looks really similar. I don't have it here, but I'll show you after. And that does get around not knowing phi, but I don't think you can do that for a time varying rate, because then you're going to have these rate correlations that are due to the rate. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky to do that. I mean, you can compute for the VAR CE, you can kind of sub-select the data so that you always have the same distribution of spike counts, but you can't really do that for a temporal correlation analysis because you don't have the same conditions contributing to each bin. Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I think certainly doing population analysis would get around a lot of these problems for sure. But I mean, ultimately, I mean, when you record the population data, you still end up with the problem that your data are reflecting both the point process and the VAR CE. But you're right, though, you can assume that any variance that there's shared variance and independent variance. Yeah, no, I think it would be great to do population analysis. I mean, it's really tough to do that in LIP of a monkey, right? I mean, you can't just slap a Utah array in the bottom of a sulcus. But I agree with you, it would be a great way to get at this problem for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it does, yeah. Well, yeah, no, that's exactly right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so the reason that you're right, and we don't see that in the data, and that, we've known that for a while, and that was kind of one of several pieces of information that had led us to wonder whether there was a collapsing bound. So if you have a non-stationary bound that's decreasing over time, then you expect to have a different distribution of error and correct RTs. You expect to have longer error RTs, which is what we see in the data. Sort of, yeah. I mean, not exactly. We had wondered for a long time whether the bound was non-stationary for the reason that you described, and also for a couple of other reasons. The distributions, the RT distributions that you predict from a simple drift diffusion model have very long tails. We don't see that. It's as if the tails are kind of clipped. And there was also this observation about the error RTs. And this had made us wonder whether the bound just had a lower value as time went by. And we really looked in the data, and it really doesn't. Because you can look at firing rate at the end of the trial as a function of RT, and you can get it this really precisely, is the bound collapsing, and it's not. But what we think is instead the alternative instantiation of this same mechanism is not to have the bound be non-stationary, but instead to add some time-varying increase to the data. And we think we see that in LIP. We see that the overall firing rate reflects partly the accumulation of evidence and also partly reflects this time-varying signal that appears to be a lot more, you know, fairly deterministic. And it's different for 2 and 4 choice. And when we incorporate that signal into the model, then we can match the RTs, match the firing rates, and match the RT distributions and the correct versus error RTs. Well, because this isn't... Yeah, this is an SPRT, right? Yeah, this is not SPRT because if you know what the quality of the evidence is, then you have a very different strategy, and you would certainly not need to invoke a collapsing bound. You would just set your bound at some probability correct, whatever it was you wanted, and it would be done. But this bound is not in units of probability correct. You can tell that right from the get-go just by looking at the psychometric function. So yeah, he doesn't know the quality of the evidence, or he doesn't know it very well, and so he has to invoke a different strategy. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.